That's something I don't do every day. Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club's Inforum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find Inforum online at informsf.org. I'm Jen Lam, CEO of Delivering Happiness and consultant at Zappos, and your moderator for the evening. And tonight we're here for Inforum's event, Chip Conley, Happiness and Hospitality, a Business Model. So Chip has had his hand in so many different projects and businesses, but most of you guys probably know him for his endeavor, Joie de Vivre, here, started in San Francisco. And I would say that's probably one of the earliest examples where you have, can couple these two things called economic success and happiness at the workplace, hand in hand. And most recently, he's joined as head of hospitality at Airbnb. But for me, when I think of Chip, I met him about 5 years ago at TED. And when we first sat down, the first thing I could think of was good person. And I mean that with a capital G and P. And so I was really honored that you invited me to be the moderator tonight. Not to mention the fact you're the one of the people that I look forward to seeing most at Burning Man.
We'll talk about that.
Yeah, we will talk about that. So let's begin.
It's great to be here with you, Jen. Thank you.
Thank you.
And with lots of people I know here, so it's great to see all of you.
It's like family.
Makes me realize how old I am. And how old you are, too.
So let's dive in then. It's always going to be a good conversation when I don't know where to start, just because you have so many things going on, and you're such an interesting all-around guy. But maybe we should start with Joie de Vivre. Tell me a little bit about that, because all I know is that story of you having graduated from Stanford Business School, and then 2 years later, you decided to buy a hotel,
right,
a pay-by-hour hotel,
yeah,
in the Tenderloin, and start a business. And eventually made it one of the I think is the second biggest boutique
hotel
chain
in the U.S.
In the U.S.
Yeah.
So tell me, what were you even thinking at that time, and how did you get there?
Okay, thanks. First of all, it's nice to be here with all of you. I appreciate the Commonwealth Club. I think it's got a great history, and it's nice to be in a city where people want to talk about things and learn about things. So for me, I graduated from Stanford Business School when I was 23. I was quite young, and a couple years later, I was realizing that the work I was doing for a real estate developer felt more like a job than a calling. And at some point, I'll talk about Maslow tonight, and I really believe, based upon Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you can have one of three relationships with your work. It's either a job, a career, or a calling, and think of it in a pyramid. Most of us have a job, and that's the base of the pyramid. And I didn't want to have a job. I wanted to have a calling. And I knew something about real estate. I knew nothing about hotels. But what I loved about hotels is they combine real estate with making people happy. And the job I had in real estate was to negotiate, to manage a construction site and a contractor, and to negotiate leases. And generally, I wasn't making people very happy or myself very happy in that process. So the company I was working for, Bay West Development, and Bill Poland was looking at doing a hotel south of Market where the Zynga building is now at 8th and Townsend. And it was a yellow cab site that at that point where the yellow cabs all collected. And we were going to do a hotel there, and so I was the guy doing the feasibility study for the hotel. We didn't do the hotel, but it taught me about hospitality. And what I loved about hospitality is if you did your job well, you made people happy, and you did well financially. So I decided I'd go find a hotel in town to buy because we didn't do that project. And the only thing I could afford at age 26, and it was not my money, I raised about $1 million from a variety of people, was this motel in the Tenderloin that was rather infamous. It was called the Caravan Lodge. Any of you ever go to the Caravan Lodge before I bought it? Oh, I'm not supposed to. Yes. So long story short is it was a place that was very popular at lunchtime. And it did not have an open restaurant at lunchtime. So But what I learned pretty quickly from that experience, the motel became known the Phoenix, rising from its ashes, which, if you don't know, is the city bird for San Francisco because of the earthquake and fire. So the Phoenix became a rock and roll hotel and was rather quickly pretty successful at attracting bands and musicians. I called the company Joie de Vivre because there was a company in San Francisco back then called Esprit. Remember Esprit, Esprit de Corps? And back in the mid-1980s when this all was happening, Esprit was a vibrant company that had a really robust culture. And I believed back at age 25 or 26 that culture is what drives success in a company. And so I decided to come up with a different French phrase than, as opposed to esprit de corps. I came up with joie de vivre. And at the end of the day, what I really liked about that is that we were one of the few companies in the world whose mission statement was also the name of the company. So we were in the business of creating joy of life. So that's how I got started. Mm-hmm. And the company grew for a lot of great reasons. But I'll let you ask another question.
Right. I think those were motels back in the day of the pay by hour. Isn't that the equivalent of a love hotel in Japan?
It is. I felt like the last hotel I ever want to do in my life is a pay by the hour hotel again, but really upscale and right in the right location where, yeah. Yeah.
We should do a field trip to Tokyo, I think.
About 6 weeks ago, so yeah.
Nice. So you're already there. I guess if you could take away one of the biggest lessons learned from that experience.
Yeah.
What would it be?
Well, I think as an entrepreneur, the best advice I can give. So Stuart Brand, who Steve Jobs admired, who created the Whole Earth Catalog, once said or wrote, "Start if you're going to start a business, start cheap, small, and local." And the reason to do that is because your mistakes will be small. And I think that was true for me, is that while we ultimately grew and over the course of about a quarter century, I was involved in creating 52 boutique hotels. That first hotel lasted 3.5 years before the second one happened. And I think going after a niche audience, what we learned is if you're going to have a motel in the Tenderloin, you better have a niche audience other than Vinny and his girls, who it's our big corporate account when I took over the place. And so figuring out who that niche is and then creating the best product for that niche so that they go out and all tell their friends. Back in the day, it was word of mouth, and today it's word of mouse. You know, it's all about how you get the word out to a collection of people who are your evangelists. And so our real strategy was to be the best rock and roll hotel in the world and to do it right here in a bad neighborhood, or what was perceived as a bad neighborhood, a neighborhood I love. I love the Tenderloin. But it was creating something that met the needs of those people. The other thing I learned was this: is who do you think is the decision maker of where a band stays when they're on the road? I thought it was the travel agent who books them, and there's a bunch of travel agents in L.A., New York, and Nashville who do that. But that's not the primary decision maker. No. Then I thought it was okay. Well, it's the venue. It's like wherever they're going. If they're going to Slim's, the Great American Music Hall, the Fillmore, Warfield. No, that wasn't it. The number one decision maker of where a band stays is the band manager, the tour manager, who's usually about 3 years older than the rest of the band. And he, and it's almost always a he, is basically herding cats, trying to figure out how to make sure these people don't have overdoses or groupies like hijack them off, you know, so that they get lost. So what we found was that the number one thing we did from a marketing perspective was the tour manager, we realized that these guys were really stressed out, and we had one room of our 44 rooms at the Phoenix that used to be the massage treatment room. And back in the illegitimate massage days, we had to like take some serious, serious cleanser to that room. But we kept it. We actually cleaned it up and made it a legitimate massage room, and we had a massage therapist there. And what we offered that made the huge difference and got all the word out was every tour manager who brought 10 room nights to us. So that's like 5 rooms times 2 nights, would get a free massage when they came to the Phoenix. And what was fascinating is how quickly that word spread amongst the tour managers. There's only about maybe 100 tour managers in the country who do all of the touring. And because we were meeting a need that they had, which was, I'm stressed out and I don't have time to go out and get a massage and I don't want to spend the money on it, the fact that we gave them that free massage was what really spread the word. And then 2 years later, People Magazine did a big story. And then Linda Ronstadt took the whole hotel. And then the Chronicle asked if they could have a reporter in the hotel while she was there. And she said it was fine as long as they didn't write the story until afterwards. And and that after that, after about 2 years of being in business, it was very clear that we were, we were the Rock and Roll Hotel. But the other thing we learned from that was that each time, if you're going to create a boutique hotel, it's got to have its own soul and personality. So every time we created a hotel, it was based upon a magazine and five adjectives, because boutique hotels and magazines have something in common. They're very niche oriented and very lifestyle oriented. So that first hotel, the Phoenix, was based upon Rolling Stone, and the five adjectives were funky, irreverent, adventurous, cool, and young at heart. And so everything we did in creating the hotel came back to those five adjectives. But the magic of what we learned is that the people who fell in love with the hotel were people who would use those five adjectives to describe themselves. So like Dr. Timothy Leary, how many of you know Dr. Timothy Leary? So Dr. Timothy, very well-known Harvard psychologist who was giving LSD to his students back in the 60s. He was a regular at the hotel in his dying days, in his last days of his life. He didn't fit the demographic of the Phoenix, which were 25-year-old tattooed male musicians from LA, but he fit the psychographic of the Phoenix, which was funky, irreverent, adventurous, cool, and young at heart, which is the personality of Rolling Stone. It was the product we created. And ultimately, the people who loved the hotel got what I call an identity for refreshment. Their identity of how they saw themselves was refreshed by staying there. So that's really, there's a lot of things I'm very proud of in the hotel business, but 52 hotels later, we've created 52 hotels, every single one of its own brand, based upon a different magazine and five adjectives. And that approach has allowed us to create very soulful hotels that do more than just have people stay in them. They create a emotional connection with the guests. So it's like the hotel is a mirror for the customer, or the customer's aspirations.
Right. 52 comes up a lot. So basically you had 52 kids along the way.
I did, yeah. Each one was a kid.
Right. So I know we're not supposed to ask parents, like, who was their favorite kid. But but who would you, which hotel would you say was the closest as to what you envisioned it? And which hotel was the furthest from it?
Well, that's a great question. Well, there's a hotel down the street here that was incredibly hard to build. Called the Hotel Vitale, which was a new construction hotel we built on city land at the corner of Mission and the Embarcadero. And in 1997, the city decided, I don't know, some of you who have not lived in San Francisco a long time don't know the era of when the Embarcadero used to be a freeway. And then when the freeway came down after the earthquake, it was okay, but it wasn't the best neighborhood. And there was actually a Muni bus parking lot at the across the street from Boulevard Restaurant. And Muni decided that they wanted to actually earn revenue from this lot, and so they did a RFP, and long story short is we won the request for proposals, and it took us 4 years, as is normal in San Francisco, to get all the approvals from seven different commissions. And then right as we got their approvals, 9/11 happened, and so we spent 2 years paying rent to the city. We couldn't get financing for the hotel. Ultimately, we built the Vitale, and what I had in my gut felt was that there was a customer for the bourgeois bohemian crowd, the Bobos of the world, which represents a lot of you in the room. You're a Bobo if you don't know it. It's a David Brooks term. Bourgeois bohemian basically means somebody who's affluent but also sort of organic. They're sort of interested. It's very, it's like Mill Valley. Come on. So I felt there were a lot of people who fit that profile. There are a lot of business women who fit that profile. And these are people who were what I called post-W, pre-Four Seasons. And as it... Yeah, does that make sense? Is that you? Yeah. So that's what we created. And, in the worst market, we started building it October of 2003. Like, that was dot-com bust, the bottom of the market. We opened in March of 2005, and within 3 months after it opened, it was the highest occupancy hotel in its competitive set, and it just continued from then on. So that was a huge success. And I think it also proved that it proved one thing that a lot of people said I was wrong about, is it said, you know, business people come to town, they're not looking for lifestyle things. They don't want a yoga class in the hotel. And we had yoga studio in the hotel, and we did yoga classes every morning for free. They're like, what are you talking about? This is a business hotel. People don't do yoga. It's like, you know, the more and more when people say, is it a business traveler or is it a leisure traveler? I show them my iPhone and I say, we're both. I mean, when's our business? When's our leisure? It's work-life frappe. So I think that people want, because we mix our work and our leisure, because we now have gadgets that sort of force that upon us, the more we can actually create leisure in business, that's better. And as it turns out, I think I was right. In terms of the hotel, that probably was the biggest problematic hotel, but I still loved the idea of it, was this place down on Highway 1, Costa Nova. Costa Nova is between Half Moon Bay and Santa Cruz. And in 1998 or 1999, it opened. 1999, I think it opened. And the idea behind it was a luxury campground, which is an oxymoron. the idea was, wow, there's a lot of people. Here's the premise. The premise was, we want to do for camping what Starbucks did for coffee. So what Starbucks did for coffee is they upscaled the coffee product in America, and all of a sudden, there were people who were willing to pay a lot more for coffee because it was a better coffee product. I felt the same way about camping. I want to camp. I'm an Eagle Scout, but I don't want to get my hands dirty. I was an Eagle Scout. I don't necessarily want to camp the old-fashioned way. And I think there's lots and lots of two-income families in the Bay Area who have a little bit of money who'd say, yeah, let's go stay in a tent that's already pitched for us with a mattress with a heater in it and go and put on our bathrobes to go to the campground bathrooms that have heated floors and fireplaces in them and a sauna. Why not? That sounds right, right? So I think it was a great premise. The process of building anything on the California coast with the Coastal Commission was incredibly challenging. And then we opened pretty well, but then we had the buzzsaw of the dot-com bust. And our corporate retreat business on weekdays just dried up completely. And so, you know, we had to sell it at a big loss in 2003 or 2004. But I think failures as being noble experiments, that experience of Costa Nova, which opened in 1999, was a really formative experience for me for Hotel Vitale. Mm. What it taught me was there's a lot of, because what we were getting on weekdays is we were getting all these dot-com companies that said, we don't want to go do a golfing resort offsite retreat. We want to do mountain biking and horseback riding on the beach and staying in tents or staying in a lodge and doing something where we get our hands dirty in nature and we do a team building around that. So that's what taught me ultimately with the Vitale, because the number one thing people wanted to do with all that adventure stuff is do yoga classes at Costa Nova. And so what it taught me is that, wow, if they want to do it there, maybe they want to do it in the city too. So sometimes your failures actually teach you something that can be a success in the future.
Yeah, for sure. If it makes you feel any better, actually, my mom and I stayed at Costa Nova.
Oh, yeah?
And right before you sold, it sounds like. I had no idea. But we had one of the most amazing times because my dad just passed away.
Mm.
So we decided to go out there.
With the ashes?
No, we left that at home.
Okay.
No, just
we had lots of people do that, actually.
No, I understand. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. Yeah. But we almost got lost and couldn't find our way back. But it built a good memory. So
yeah.
Hopefully that makes you feel better, that it was worthwhile.
Yep.
You said something earlier, work-life frappe.
Yes.
And with Delivering Happiness, Tony and Zappos, we say work-life integration.
Mm.
So tomato, tomato, potato, potato. I'd like to explore that a little bit because, again, like you were one of the first early pioneers in understanding financial success plus happiness in the workplace. Mm-hmm. And that largely boils down to having a really strong company culture.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what I'm really interested in hearing is, like, going through all these different experiences and companies and hotels, how is it that you see culture now that can be a competitive differentiator in a way that is not a buzzword because everyone's saying, oh, yeah, we're focusing on culture, but what is it really that differentiates culture as something that can be a competitive advantage in the end?
So Tony Shea, the founder and one of the founders and CEO of of Zappos has a great phrase: your culture is your brand. And people spend a lot of money on branding their company and sort of putting the veneer on. But at the end of the day, the soul of the company is the culture. And so if I were to define culture, first of all, just to make sure we're defining it properly, it's I like to call it, it's what happens when the boss is not around. Basically, it's it's the way things are done around here because it's sort of ingrained in the DNA of the organization. If you're a hospitality company, I mean, I think what's so awful about so many people who get into the hospitality business for the wrong reason, because actually, unfortunately, I believe the hospitality business, which used to be a big H and a small B, has become a small H and a capital B, in the sense that in the old days, it was like the Swigs owned the Fairmont, and there was a family mentality about how hotels were run. And today, a lot of people who own hotels are private equity firms and companies that see it as a asset allocation of their real estate. And that's sad, because what I believe from a hospitality perspective is that the culture of how you treat your employees says an enormous amount of how they're going to treat their customers, our customers. And it makes logical sense. I call it karmic capitalism. It's like what goes around comes around. If you're going to treat your people well, they'll treat your customers well. If you treat your customers well, there's more loyalty. If there's more loyalty, you actually grow market share. If you grow market share, you're more profitable. And then the investors are the last ones to actually get the benefit. And that's the way it should be. It starts with the employees and ends with the investors. That's, to me, and then the investors invest back in culture, and it's a virtuous circle. So the question I ask, I was giving a talk about this not long ago, and a CEO of a Fortune 500 company came up to me and whispered to me off stage after the speech, and he said, "I don't think we have a culture." So there's people listening in. I'm just going to say it loud and loudly. I don't think we have a culture. And I said to him, "Well, do you have a personality?" And he said, "Of course I have a personality." He was very boisterous then. He was like whispering about no culture. And then his personality, yes. And I said, if you have a personality, your company has a culture. If you don't think you have a culture, you probably have a bad culture. And so I think really that what is most important about culture is the intentionality of it. And what's the culture? What are the core values? Zappos is quite famous for its core values. In fact, if you go online and look and you actually write in the core values in Google, what first comes up first on almost every single one of them is Zappos' website, which says that, okay, those core values are not just ingrained in the company, but they're actually well-known out there in the world. So, and that's when your culture is your brand, if the world knows your core values. So for me, I just think that the way you can determine whether a company is getting it or not is, do the core values, or maybe even the five adjectives. Remember, I said five adjectives per hotel. Well, you can have five adjectives that describes a culture. Are the five adjectives that you'd use to describe your culture the same five adjectives your employees would use? And could your customers even figure them out? And if there's a complete disconnect there and a misalignment, something's wrong. And if the five adjectives you're going to use are the ones that any company is going to use, then you really haven't gotten that intentional about your culture. You're just trying to be like everybody else. So the reason why culture is important is because it is the magnet that attracts people. You know, there's people who should go work for Oracle, and there's other people who should go work for Apple, and then there's other people who should go work for Zappos. But those are three different companies with three very different cultures, and your culture is what ultimately defines whether someone is well-suited for you or not. And I learned this from Herb Kelleher at Southwest Airlines, which is a company that has a great culture. And he said a lot of great things, but one of the things he said is, we've gotten it backwards. We've learned to love techniques and use people. As opposed to love people and use techniques. And he was a culture bearer and in a very difficult industry. And so I learned a lot from that, you know, frankly, if you create a great culture, you don't have to spend as much on advertising. You don't have to spend as much on recruiting. You don't have to spend as much on workers' comp or on severance. There's all these collateral benefits, but you've got to be intentional about the culture.
Yeah, I think that's huge. And I guess for me, I just have to thank you for being able to start that way, pioneer that way, and articulate, because it's finally not being sort of a nice-to-have idea. is actually becoming more and more prevalent as a sort of a global paradigm shift of how do you actually, you know, look towards the next generation of how do you build a sustainable business, not just the fact that it's about humans, yep. but that it should go hand in hand. So, as
there was a, I think it was a year ago or 2 years ago, it was January, February issue of this Harvard Business Review. And yeah. was it 2 years ago or 1 year ago? I don't remember. But
it's about a year and a half.
Yeah. So, Harvard Business Review, which is a pretty conservative business magazine and rather empirically driven in terms of what they look at, they had a happy face on their cover of an issue, and the title of the whole issue, the theme for the issue, was the value of happiness. And in essence, they had five or six really in-depth articles with a lot of evidence that showed that it's not success that creates happiness, it's happiness that creates success. And that in the business world, and frankly, probably in life. And so it's great. I mean, if we've gotten finally to the place where Harvard Business Review has a smiley face on the cover and is talking about how happiness is, it's proven that happiness actually creates success, you get some Fortune 500 companies to actually wake up and say, okay, what are we doing?
Right.
How are we investing in this?
Exactly.
But the worst part, and this is the thing that's terrible in a recession and in a downturn, the first thing that people tend to actually stop spending money on is the offset retreats and the HR and culture, because people feel like, okay, it's easy to actually cut back on that. And it's actually, frankly, it's the place where you should be spending money in a recession to actually help people feel like this is why we're here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I learned during the dot-com bust years ago. So.
Yeah. And that's huge. And I think that sort of ushered in this whole tipping point of how companies and people as individuals see what the new paradigm could be. Because as in Delivering Happiness in the book, we mentioned peak. We talk about, you know, Maslow's hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
So just shifting gears a little bit to your whole, love of writing, I'm taking it. You have four books now. Mm-hmm. Maybe I can ask you a little bit about what that brings to you. Like, why do you keep on writing books, and what do you dread most about when you have to write a book?
Well, so first of all, I love writing. When I was 12 years old, I said that I was a very introverted kid. It's hard to believe that today. But I was a very introverted kid, and I said to my dad when I was 12, who wanted me to be a lot more social, I said, I want to be a writer when I grow up. And he said, Chip, writers are either poor or psychotic, and most are both. and I didn't know what psychotic meant, but I was like, oh, okay, well. I read it, and I said, oh, okay. So I didn't think I was going to be a writer when I grew up, and then I became a business person, and then I decided, okay, I'm going to write about what I've learned. The third book I wrote was called Peak, How Great Companies Get Their Mojo from Maslow. And that book was the one that actually woke me up to the fact, wow, I could do this as a living. And the book did really well, and it was really a story of how in the dot-com bust, I had taken one psychology class in college, but the one thing I remembered from my psychology class from Professor Zimbardo at Stanford was Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which basically said we have base needs, like water, food, sleep, and air, and then you have other needs, and at the top of the pyramid you have this thing called self-actualization, or being all you can be. And in the dot-com bust, I started reading Maslow. I think I was looking, I had a company called Joie de Vivre, and I didn't feel a whole lot of joie de vivre, during the dot-com bust. And I really was looking for a clue. And I started reading some Maslow books. And then I asked, how do we create a self-actualized company? And that process of actually creating a model around Maslow's hierarchy of needs, because Maslow died at age 62. For those who know a little bit about Maslow, he died at age 62, quite young. He was actually down in Menlo Park. He was an East Coast guy who spent the last few years of his life here in the Bay Area, working for the Saga Corporation on Sand Hill Road. And he was focused on how to actually create happiness in the workplace and self-actualization in the workplace. He wrote a book on it that sold 3,000 copies, never really got very far, and then he died. So once I started learning all of that, I was like, wow, I didn't say this at the time to my team, but I said, I want to channel Abe Maslow. Let's look at how we apply Abe Maslow's theory organizationally. And that's what we did. We created a whole model around that, and it worked for us. We were really in bad shape. All of our hotels were here in the Bay Area, and the Bay Area was the worst hotel market in the country. But we tripled in size between 2001 and 2007. And so I ended up writing the book. And that taught me that loved writing as a means of trying to understand what I had learned. And it was a way of sharing it as well. But, you know, if you, you know, they say the best learners are leaders are learners who teach, something like that. And that's actually what I am. I am a learner who teaches. And I sometimes teach giving speeches. I sometimes teach writing books. For a long time, I taught as a CEO. So I love that. I love the, I'm a curious soul. I went to Long Beach Poly High School. I'm so proud of that place. In the inner city of Long Beach, Snoop Dogg's high school. And they called me Curious White Boy when I was growing up. And I was the Curious White Boy. And I'm still curious. I'm still a Curious White Boy. And I love learning. And so I love looking at how to apply things. And so Maslow helped me with that. This book, Emotional Equations, my last book, was I went through the dot-com bust and I felt like a gladiator as the CEO. And in this most recent recession, I felt like a prisoner. And so the psychologist I channeled this time was Viktor Frankl, who wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning. And for those of you who don't know that book, it's a story of a psychologist from Vienna whose basic belief in the 1930s was the thing that actually creates meaning in life. What creates sustenance in life, what creates a sense of fuel in life is when you find meaning and how you find meaning in life. And then he ended up in a concentration camp, which is a really fascinating story. That's his belief. And then he got to see in a concentration camp who had meaning, who didn't, who lived, who didn't. And he wrote probably the most famous secular book ever written on meaning, Man's Search for Meaning. So I, without going into a lot of detail, for those who read the book, you'll read it in the first few pages. I had an awful 2008 and 2009, including a time when I had a broken ankle, a bacterial infection in my leg, and was giving a speech in St. Louis, and actually literally died on stage. I had a flatline experience and went flatline 9 times in 90 minutes. And in the, I was in the emergency room in the ICU, and then that night, I asked the nurse who was caring for me if she'd go get my briefcase and bring it over to me. And she wagged her finger at me. She said, "That's what got you in here in the first place." No, I said, "There's actually a book in that briefcase that I want to look at." And I had Man's Search for Meaning in the book, in my briefcase, because I had been in a place where one of my best friends had committed suicide, and his name was Chip. And I was in a really struggling place myself, and I was really looking for a clue in life. And that in that hospital room, I stayed up all night long and wrote an equation that sort of distilled this wisdom of Frankl down to something that was actionable in an equation. It was despair equals suffering minus meaning. And that became my despair equals suffering minus meaning. The way that the math works is the more meaning you have, if suffering is sort of a constant, and if you're a Buddhist, it's the number one, it's the first noble truth of Buddhism, it's suffering is ever present. But, you know, when you're going through difficult times, suffering does feel like a constant. So if you increase the meaning and suffering is a constant, despair goes down. And that's what I learned. And I learned that in a hospital room in St. Louis in the hardest of times. And my life the next 3 months got a lot better, even though the economy got a lot worse. I didn't want to be running my company anymore. I had a bunch of other things going wrong too. And I ultimately got to a place where I introduced that equation to all of our general managers and all of our managers in the company, and then started teaching emotional intelligence to employees in the company, because what you need to help people with in a difficult time is their emotions. And usually that's not what companies teach. And what it taught me was that helping people understand their emotions is something we need to do in the business world and just in the general world. And so that ultimately this book came out of that. And this book was when I really said, okay, I can't be a CEO anymore. I need to go spend more time writing and learning. Mm. So
nice. Well, one of the things I love about what you do is how you weave in the whole psychology of life and emotion and meaning with this thing called happiness, but in a very rooted, measurable way.
Right.
I think so many of us forget that, you know, even back, you're naming all these psychologists, philosophers. Aristotle thought about this in 200 BC.
Socrates.
Happiness, yep. It's the existence of our being. It's dependent on ourselves. And yet here you're like, I love how you're doing it on a current way mm-hmm. to make it meaningful for people.
It was fun. I went to Bhutan, and I was lucky enough to actually give a TED talk about this. Going to Bhutan as a corporate CEO to study the Gross National Happiness Index in Bhutan, because they were the first country to do it about 40 years ago, and then say, what is it to be learned from Bhutan that we could take back to the corporate world? And we did. And we created a happiness equation, which really is all based upon gratitude. And how do you actually focus on gratitude as opposed to just gratification? And, it's been fun. It's been a real opportunity to, you know, truthful, I'm somebody who tried to outrun my emotions. I've always been anybody who knows me well knows I have a lot on my plate. I always am doing a lot. It has a lot to do with probably as a young teenager running away from what I was feeling inside and doing everything I could to be that more extroverted person that both my parents wanted me to be. And so feeling my feelings was not something I wanted to do. So activity and achievement is what got me going. And so slowing down to actually feel stuff, ooh. So writing a book on emotional equations was really a hard thing to do, but very valuable in terms of the number of emails and letters I've gotten from around the world from people, predominantly men. Between 2008 and 2010, I had five friends commit suicide, all of them men in their 40s, three of them entrepreneurs who own their companies. And so much of it was because men were outrunning their emotions. Men didn't have an ability to process the failure they were feeling in that downturn. And if if their own personal identity was so attached to their company and their company was going under, you know, that's where they were going too.
Yep, understood. I just got a signal I think we're less than 8 minutes left. So I'm just going to shift gears a little bit.
Yeah. Before the Q&A.
Before the Q&A.
Okay,
and just to get things maybe a little bit more juicier.
Yes.
Not that they haven't been already. But as I mentioned earlier, we see each other about definitely once a year at this thing called Burning Man.
Yeah.
And I guess one of the things is, and now you're a board member there. Mm-hmm. And you've been going for how long now?
Since about 15 years.
15 years. And so I started going 3 years ago. And what I love about Burning Man is this whole notion of people either hate it, the idea of it, or they love it because they've been there, etc. And so I just like to dispel what is it really that makes you a veteran of Burning Man. And like everyone's talking, oh, it's so commercial now. Why does everyone go? There's 50,000 people. It distills like the real nature of Burning Man. So what is it about it that keeps you going back?
Well, I want to talk about festivals in general. So, I mean, I think Burning Man is a festival. Although as a board member, we don't call it a festival, we call it an event. But the reality is it's a festival. And there's a guy named Emile Durkheim, who's a sociologist, French sociologist from 102 years ago, 1912. He coined an expression that I think absolutely defines what Burning Man is and what festivals are all over the world. And he called it collective effervescence. And what happens at Burning Man, and then I'll talk about other festivals, is this miraculous emotional alchemical experience happens. And that is that each of us who are separate and have our egos that separate us in the world, in that environment, most of us find that our sense of separation evaporates or it just goes down. And what we feel we filled up with is this communal joy, this collective effervescence. Burning Man is an extreme version of it. It's very tribal. But the idea of festivals, and actually festivals are making an enormous comeback around the world right now, for those of you who don't know it. And the New York Times is covering them a lot more, and the Chronicle's actually even got a section on them occasionally on Sundays. Long story short is, I'm fascinated by this. And that's we created a website called Fest 300 that is launched, but the full website's not up till May, featuring the world's best festivals. And that's part of my job is to go to the world's 300 best festivals and then write about it and then share it, and then help you find the festival right for you that's going to be a transformative experience. So that's not a bad job. But I do think what happens in these festival environments, and when I'm saying festival, I'm talking about all kinds, cultural festivals. This time last year, I was at Kumbh Mela, which is 100 million people at the Ganges River in India. It's a Hindu religious pilgrimage that happens every 12 years, a big one, and every 3 years, a smaller one. And it's phenomenal. So, I think the idea of how we're actually creating communal joy in the world is, to me, pretty important as we have less elbow room. We have 7 billion people now. We'll have 10 billion people in about 30 years.
I'm not sure if that's an awesome business idea or a very expensive hobby.
Yeah, good question.
Not quite sure. So we're going to be getting to your live questions in about 5 minutes. So if you have something to ask Chip, you want to formulate your question and line up at the mic right about now. Reminder, we're looking for multiple choice, multi-part questions. I'm just kidding. Looking for very simple one-part questions, and lengthy setups or multiple-part questions are a no-no, according to this. So I guess maybe the current, your Airbnb, director of hospitality, are you? I'm guessing you're sending a shudder of, trepidation. In the hospitality world, taking this on.
So I still, I'm no longer CEO. I sold a majority of the company to a guy named John Pritzker about 3.5 years ago, and really have been very excited by seeing where they're going. And Nikki Leondakis is the new CEO, and a wonderful. She was the president of Kimpton for a long time. Great. So it's wonderful, and it's allowed me to go do other things. And so I was doing other things, and out of the blue, about 10 months ago, Brian Chesky, who's one of the co-founders and CEOs of Airbnb, approached me. He's 21 years younger than me. He's got a lot more zeros in his net worth than I do. And he just said, I want you to help mentor me. I want to help understand, you know, what does it mean to grow and be a CEO of a company you founded over a long period of time. And I want our tech company to become a hospitality company. And so I said, okay, great. I'll help you out a little bit. And I gave a speech on hospitality innovation at Airbnb headquarters. And next thing I knew, he was saying, well, I want you to be the head of global hospitality for the company. And I said, I'm retired. I'm sort of just doing fun stuff. But the more I learned about Airbnb, and I really didn't know much about it at that time, about 10 or 11 months ago. But the more I learned about it, I was like, wow, this is going to be the largest provider of accommodations probably within the next 3 years. I mean, bigger than Hilton. It's a different model, completely different model, and it's certainly shaking up communities in all kinds of good and bad ways in terms of how people perceive it. But what I love about the company is it's turning strangers into friends. Basically, for those of you who don't know about Airbnb is a company that took something that's been happening forever, which is people have been staying around the world with other people, and usually it's through family and friends that made the connection. And they use technology and great design, because two of the three founders are from the Rhode Island School of Design. And they created a website that allowed people to have a certain sense of trust so that they could go stay in Paris in an apartment, either a whole apartment by themselves, or they could stay with someone who lives there and in an extra bedroom. And it's huge in terms of how it's growing. 10 million people, 10 million guests over the last 5 years. What I love about it is it's creating, we have almost 600,000 listings in 192 countries now, and it's creating micro-entrepreneurs all around the world. My job, part of my job, is really about how to spread the art and science of the generosity of hospitality around the world in 192 countries. So like, wow. It's like I'm part of the UN or something. And that's what feels great, is how do you actually spread that spirit of hospitality. So I'm loving it, and it's been a great experience.
Yeah. I first used it, I think, 4 months ago, and I'm a huge fan.
Yeah.
So whatever you're doing, keep it up.
Well, we're trying to help our hosts be better at hospitality. And so, we're excited about that.
It's nice. So okay. I guess we're going to go into our Q&A portion now. As a reminder to our radio audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Clubs Inforum, Connect Your Intellect. For more about Inforum and its upcoming events, please visit us on Facebook or follow @InforumSF on Twitter. Tonight, again, we're hosting Chip Conley, Happiness and Hospitality, a Business Model. I'm Jen Lim, CEO of Delivering Happiness and consultant at Zappos. Now, let's hear from our audience. And remember, we're looking for single, one-part questions that are actually questions. All right, so...
Let's go over here.
Hi, Chip. I met you earlier. I told you I'm a volunteer here, and I volunteer quite frequently. I've had the pleasure to meet many different people from the Bay Area and elsewhere. I find your outlook on life and business extremely innovative and refreshing. But I'd like to go back to the start. When you decided to buy the Phoenix Hotel, did you have $1 million to write the check? Did you have investors? How exactly did you go about financing that?
Sure. So that I just turned 26. I finished the business plan on my 26th birthday. I'm not from a wealthy family. I'm from a middle class family, but I went to Stanford for undergrad and Stanford Business School. So I always.
I'm going to forgive you that.
Okay, all right. So what I was going to say about that was that there were people who I went to college with and business school with who had some money. And so I raised $1.1 million. Average, it was 1986, 1987. Average person put about $40,000 in, so it was a lot of different investors. And they were not investing in the real estate. I mean, we didn't even own the land. We still don't even own the land there. It was a long-term land lease. And they were investing, I guess, in me, and they really believed in me, and that I, you know, they believed in my vision about what we were doing, and they thought it would be sort of fun to throw a party in the courtyard occasionally there, because it is, for those of you who have been to the Phoenix, it's a great place to throw a party. But that's really, they were really believing in me, and so I think, frankly, when people are investing in young entrepreneurs, that's usually what they're doing. They're investing in the person as much or more than the concept.
I understand. Thank you.
Yes.
So thank you for coming. My question is around how could one get started on developing a culture in an industry that really hasn't had to think about it as much before? Some of these organizations are quite old. I'm thinking about healthcare in general, which is the industry I work in. How can we get these organizations? So I'm, you know, jumping in, recent grad, trying to create culture change. What's some advice from you?
So here's the number. Here's a very important statistic that's fascinating. The number one variable of successful hospitals in the United States is not where they're located. It's not how many specialist doctors do they have. It's not how do they do their insurance programs. The number one variable for successful hospitals in the United States is how happy are the nurses. True. And happy nurses create a ripple effect in all kinds of other ways. So I think the best thing I could advise you is that there's actually really, in the last 5 years, a lot of good data around how do you focus on employee and patient happiness and the experience in ways that actually create a more robust financial opportunity for hospitals that historically didn't have to be competitive financially and now do. So.
Thank you.
Robert.
Chip, first of all, thanks for being here, and you are just an inspiration for all of us. Got a question. I think we actually kicked this around a long time ago, and the idea is there's a cohort of people like me, baby boomers, getting older. You talked about love hotels. I'd like to hear you talk about this desire for control that baby boomers have and the economic opportunities in hospitality for what I call the Hotel California. You check in, but you never check out. So those people who are consciously deciding to end their lives.
Ah, wow. Well, there's an interesting article recently about a place in Colorado where people are consciously going and getting high, because it's now, you can do that there. And some of the people who are doing that there are people who are late in life, and they're actually getting high because marijuana is something that people do, especially if they're addressing some cancer issues. So that's creating a hotel. There's a guy named Frank Ostaszewski, actually, who created the Zen Hospice Center, and so I'm quite close with him and his longtime, now his wife, Vanda Marlow, who have worked with death and dying. I actually think there is a market for helping people to find a place beyond hospice that is, you know, interesting, hospice and hospitality, same root, hospitals as well, that gives people a place where they can have the dreams of their life. I'm working on a project down in Todos Santos, down in Baja, an hour north of Cabo San Lucas. It's a 1,000-acre development based upon wellness and vitality for people in the last half of their life. It'll open in about 2 years, a year and a half to 2 years from now. It's called Tres Santos. And part of it is that. It's not actually for people who are about to literally die, but it's for people later in life. How do you feel vital in the last 30 to 40 years of your life? But yeah, I haven't gotten to the point. I'm actually not doing any other hotels right now. The last hotel I'm doing is for Joie de Vivre is the Epiphany, which opens in Palo Alto, downtown Palo Alto, in about three or four weeks. But I'll keep that one in mind.
Awesome.
Chip, thanks so much for coming. Really loved what you did with Joie de Vivre, and it really seemed like kind of the evolution of the hotel from, you know, the old Sheraton and Standard Hotel days. To having a boutique hotel that really had a culture about it. Mm-hmm. As Airbnb is perhaps the next evolution in hospitality, how do you control that culture and that experience where you're not able to control the rooms, the decor, the staff, mm-hmm. and everything under one roof?
So we can certainly influence the culture of the company, Airbnb, but in terms of how do you influence 500,000 hosts around the world, the way you do it is you, I think, focus on both extrinsic and intrinsic motivation. So intrinsic motivation is what actually gives you a sense of calling and why you feel like you want to do it just for the sake of doing it. Extrinsic is the financial side. The financial side relates to how do we actually help our best hosts, and this is something we're going to be really looking at very closely this year, how do we make sure our search results come up with results that show that the best hosts, the people who are actually get the best reviews, how do we evolve the review system so it's even more clear? How do the best hosts get the best financial results? And then how do we actually tell stories and give recognition from our guests telling stories about their hosts so that the best hosts in the world, we're chronicling their best practices. And so that hosts around the world can read about a host in Sydney, Australia, or Singapore, or Seattle, and what they did and say, wow, I could do that too. So a lot of it is through storytelling. So how do we use stories and as well as the technology platform as a means of helping to spread the word that, you know, the people who actually who are spreading hospitality the way they are the best should actually be the most rewarded in terms of how their search results are and how their review system helps them.
So, Chip, once again, thank you for being here. My name's Oliver. I actually work for the Four Seasons Hotel here in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And you touched on one subject before that I've read a lot about recently. It's emotional intelligence and how that affects your company culture. Are there what resource did you use to find out about emotional intelligence before? And is there anything you can think of that is now out there that I can use to help
sure.
better manage my employees?
So the best quote I've ever heard on emotional intelligence was written by Viktor Frankl before emotional intelligence was an idea. And he wrote it in Man's Search for Meaning. And here it is. It's three sentences long. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is your power to choose your response. In your response lies your growth and your freedom. So basically what he's saying is you can either be responsive or reactive in life. And between stimulus and response, the more space you can create to be responsive as opposed to reactive, the better. So Daniel Goleman, 18 years ago, wrote the book that people had been talking about emotional intelligence before, but Daniel Goleman wrote the book on it. And it's called Emotional Intelligence. And he's written lots of books. And his most recent book is called Focus. So I would highly recommend you read anything from Daniel Goleman. And he's written a lot of books. But at this point, there's so many books written on emotional intelligence that you can actually figure out what niche of the emotional intelligence space you want. In terms of what you want to learn about. But anything by him would be a good read.
Hi, Chip. I'm Katie Meissner. I'm a Vallejo City Council member. We met a long time ago. A Vallejo City Council member.
Oh, great.
And we met.
Good
I used
luck
to work
to you.
Thank you. I've been 3 meetings so far. I just was elected. And we met a long time ago when I was at the AIDS Foundation, and Joie de Vivre had donated some rooms for AIDS Life Cycle. So I want to thank you for that.
Yep.
So my question is, as you can imagine, Vallejo's been through a lot. We went through bankruptcy. We're actually on the rise. I have a great passion for the city. But do you have suggestions for how to apply some of these theories to a political body, like a city council?
So I had the interesting fortune. The reason I broke my ankle and had the bacterial infection in my leg was because of Gavin Newsom. long story short is he had his bachelor party at AT&T Ballpark, and I was there, and I broke my ankle sliding into third base at his bachelor party. while Gavin was mayor of San Francisco, I knew him. I was his mentor when he started Plump Jack. And so I was really the guy who helped him in business. And when he became mayor, I was sort of his right-hand person behind the scenes. And so I learned a lot about government and policy and how to apply Maslow's hierarchy of needs in that environment. So why don't you reach out to me? And I'd like to talk to you more about it because it's not simple. But I will tell you that in any kind of nonprofit or any kind of governmental institution, the key is to figure out how are people paid enough so their sustenance is met, their survival needs need to be met. But then how do you actually help them remember the meaning? How do you help on a regular basis introduce those people who are doing this many times out of their sense of calling? How do you keep introducing them to the sense of meaning? But quite often what nonprofits and governments don't do well enough is the survival piece of it. And if you can't get your survival needs met, it's really hard to be focusing on the meaning piece of it. Yeah, well, that's actually Peak. I would read Peak and then just apply it to the government sphere.
My name is Timothy Faulkner. I'm about to start a restaurant in San Francisco called Eden. And what one piece of advice would you give to a young entrepreneur in the hospitality industry?
Well, first of all, restaurant business is so hard. Are you ready for that number of hours? I mean, I guess you are. So I think here's the good news. The restaurant business is no longer controlled by Michael Bauer. And it's not because Michael Bauer is a bad guy. He's the Chronicle reviewer. He's actually a good guy. But so much power was in one person's hands in the Sunday Review in the San Francisco Chronicle. Today, it is very much every single customer who comes in. So the number one thing to focus on is your staff, and especially your front of the house service staff, in terms of how do they just realize that every single person coming in here is potentially could go out and write a Yelp review, or they could go out and talk about you in some other fashion. And how do you actually create an environment where those people feel cared for, those customers feel cared for? So I think that sense that, the decor is much less important at the end of the day than the way a person feels. How a person feels when they leave a restaurant is much more important than how their stomach is feeling, or how their visual aesthetics were feeling. When they feel like they were cared for, and it was Danny Meyer's book, Setting the Table, read it. The best restaurateur in America, that book will tell you about the power of hospitality and about how to run a great restaurant.
Thank you.
Aloha. I've seen you before on here and then on Twist with Jason, and you talk a lot about these ups and downs, losing people, and kind of the journey that entrepreneurs go for. I have a friend who's just turned 24, left a huge corporate job, and I try to pound in that you kind of have everything, in this Maslow's hierarchy on the bottom needs. But to keep him stable and to keep him focused on, kind of the dream, I find him just fluctuating emotionally. And going back to when you're 26, I guess is my question. I apologize, but on a day-to-day basis, how do you execute with so much going on and with so much bandwidth as a first-time entrepreneur facing so many challenges?
So the first piece of advice I give to young entrepreneurs today is don't take it so seriously. And that's a hard thing for an entrepreneur to hear, and especially if they've got a venture capitalist or other money partners who are like saying, it's 24 hours a day. But the biggest curse and gift that young entrepreneurs do is they completely align their sense of identity with the success or failure of their business. The good side of that is that they are all in. The bad side of that is they are all in. And they have nothing outside of that to balance it out. And so personally, what I ultimately found was that while a lot of people I know end up spending most of their non-work times with other entrepreneurs talking and lamenting and learning from each other, I found that my best thing was hanging out with my friends who are artists and massage therapists and writers and could help give me some perspective on life so that I wasn't just totally, constantly, obsessively focused on the performance of my business.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hi. My name is Mike Montalban. I come from a company that made like multiple acquisitions. And so I was in one of those companies that they acquired, and then they brought me
on. How's that feeling?
Well, it's been different ever since our CEO left. You know, he's still probably like a strategic advisor, but recently they brought me onto the talent marketing team, and the whole organization is like 65,000 people big. The center headquarters is in Germany, and I don't know how to possibly, start trying to figure out how to keep everybody happy, because what we're seeing is all of the smaller companies are kind of losing their individual identity and their culture. And we're trying to be a little more hip as well, and for hiring and all that. So
let me give you some thoughts on that, if you don't mind. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I know that we're time crunched. The best thing you can do, it's like anything in life. Anything in life, when it's so big, it looks like it's impossible. You have to break it down into smaller pieces. And so you need to start with little divisions or newly acquired companies. And how do you have somebody who embodies the brand? First of all, you got to figure out what is it that defines the culture? Is there a book? Is there a perspective? Is there a value system? And then have someone be the cheerleader for that, and have that division start living that. And what happens, and I've seen it happen in some big companies, is if you do that well, what'll happen is if they start operating well, and everybody can see, wow, what are they doing over there? It starts to influence, as a ripple effect, the rest of the company. So that's what you got to do.
Thank you for that. And sorry, I only have time for one last question. Hopefully, maybe after a few hang out, Chip might be around.
I'll be here.
To help answer that. But so it's time for our one last question.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sorry.
She's going to ask it, I guess. Yes. Yeah.
I guess I have the power.
But stick around. Stick around.
Yeah. Chip's a good guy with that. It's time for our last question, and it's in informed tradition to ask all of our speakers the following. Chip, what is your 60-second idea to change the world?
Oh, okay, 60 seconds. My 60-second idea to change the world would be to require that everybody in the world goes to a festival once a year. But you have to go to a festival with people who are different than you. What the world needs now is understanding the other. And when I was in high school, I was the other. I was the white kid in a predominantly non-white school. And that was wonderful, especially on my way to Stanford, where I was absolutely dominating as a white guy, lots of white people. So long story short is I think that helping the world understand that the other person, going to a whirling dervish festival of Sufi Muslims in central Turkey, I've done that. Now I understand Sufi Muslims better. So I think helping people to go experience a festival of people different than themselves is probably my 60-second way of changing the world.
Nice. Thank you for that.
Yeah. Anyway.
Chip Conley.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chip, for sharing his thoughts with us tonight. Thank you, everyone, for being here. Now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth is adjourned.
You do that very well.